Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Somewhere in the Skies with Ryan Spread.
I have Shannon LeGros and Seth Breedlove here with me today. Oh my god, this is going to be so much fun. What's going on, guys?
So, full disclosure, guys, if I get a little wild on this show, it's because right before we started recording, I ran across the street to the Sunoco and I grabbed two bottles of diet root beer.
Ooh.
So if I start
diet, oh, you crazy man,
freaking out on the show, you know, it's not me, it's the A&W talking.
You guys have not lived until you have been in the car with Seth for hours and hours and hours, and then you make a pit stop on the road, and then he grabs all the salty and the sugary treats. You know that shit's about to go down.
Nice.
What, do that?
You do that every time we stop. We had to get road snacks, man.
On this trip, I feel like most of this road trip that we were most recently on involved everyone mocking my musical selection.
Oh,
so
no.
Well, it is slightly horrible. I mean, I'm just gonna go ahead and say that, but I still love you. It's okay.
Hey, that's what you get when you drive. You get to pick the music, man. Are you kidding?
That's what I'm saying.
But every once in a while, something would kick on and we'd both sing to something, and we'd be into Disney songs too.
Shannon makes fun of my musical selection like I'm like only listening to ballads, and this went on for like the entire trip when I was out on the West Coast. And then she got to drive the car, she gets in, she puts it on, she turns on her playlist, and for the first like five songs were like Augustana.
It would just have the N-A word, so it was alphabetical. Just didn't get to the R's where Rob Zombie was, or M from Metallica.
Sure.
Alice in Chains was in there.
You might be putting on sort of a harder exterior than is actually than your playlist actually indicates.
I love a good mix of songs, but when you are so emo, and guys, I feel really embarrassed because I'm so out of the emo thing that I didn't realize that it kind of is short for like emotional, like male kind of a thing.
Oh no!
That you have such a thickly laid playlist that there's so much of that in there that you should just wear a diaper to catch your tears while you're driving. So you just
all
like,
I listen
just
to.
Open the front so it just catches all that right all here in the pocket.
I'm imagining Dashboard Confessional, a lot of Dashboard Confessional.
No, it's not Dashboard as much. It's like Juliana Theory and a lot of like
Jimmy
World.
Thank God.
Get Up Kids.
Yep.
I feel so amazing right now. I don't know who that. No, I'm just kidding.
Guess who's going to see Newfound Glory, Seth? This guy.
I saw. So I just told my wife the other day. I saw a video popped up on Facebook, and it was the lead singer of Newfound Glory. Is it Newfound Glory that's touring with like Unwritten Law?
Yes, I believe.
Okay,
so
yeah. It was their lead singers, and as soon as I saw it, I said it was. I've never felt so old so fast.
It's so
like
true,
I
man.
Saw. Saw the lead singers and I almost cried.
Yep. Why? Why are they? How old are they?
Because they're like my age.
Yeah, they're our age. And then you go to their concerts and it's like, you know, 20 somethings, and you're like, oh boy, what am I doing here?
Yeah,
you still gotta get the lighter up in the air and just own it, man.
Absolutely. You know? All right, so I guess I'll ask a question. I'll be somewhat professional here. Seth, can you give us the origin story of Small Town Monsters? I know you're probably sick of answering this question at this point, but I know there's probably a lot of listeners hopping in right now on episode. I think we're on 153, around there.
Wow.
Can you tell us a little bit about Small Town Monsters, how it all came to be?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, congrats on that many episodes. That's crazy. That's a long period of time. And you're a busy dude with a lot of other stuff going on too. So itself is an accomplishment. So yeah, the Small Town Monsters began its life as a it was a book concept, but it was like it was driven by my absolute boredom from my medical billing job at the time. Mm-hmm. So I had this medical billing job, and I would sit there all day and listen to podcasts and stuff that were based on around paranormal topics. And I hit upon this idea of I guess like what I was trying to do was write about the cultural influence of rural monster cases on small communities where they took place. And at the time I was writing for a newspaper called the Massillon Independent, and I did a column called Slice of Life that was basically just me talking to independent business owners around a relatively small area, and then sort of getting, you know, their insights on how they ran their business and how it affected the rest of their lives and stuff like that. So I think it was driven more by that sort of like ground level look at the reality of the cases rather than where we kind of are with the series now, which is much more like cinematic. And I think still more focused on the people. But at the time, my entire focus was on the people. So that's how it began its life, was a book proposal that I sent out to a bunch of different book publishers, and they all rejected it. And about a year passed, and we ended up making Minerva Monster as a film, which was one of the cases that was in the initial book proposal that I had sent out. And then it just sort of took off from there. But I mean, it really hasn't changed that much since 2015 in terms of the fact that we are still just a completely independent production house, and we make independent features, and we run a Kickstarter at the beginning of the year that helps sort of fund what we do throughout the year. So we've been around 5 years, but we kind of hit on a formula that we like in terms of how we run everything, and that's just still how we run it.
Yeah. And I mean, every time I go to Amazon Prime, like, one of your films pops up in like the top recommended things. I don't know if that's because I, you know, this is my world and they know what I watch, or every time I swear I go to any of the algorithms on Amazon, one of your films is there, man. So I mean, there's a lot to be said for starting from the ground up and just getting noticed across the world. Did you ever think you'd make it to this point?
It's funny, because I think early on when we put out Minerva, we were just happy with sort of screening stuff in small area, you know, in small towns, and like going to libraries and doing presentations. And then things changed with like getting on Amazon and on some of these streaming platforms. My dogs are about to start fighting, so if you hear that in the background, it's
not the root beer in your tummy. It's actually the dogs.
It's just Mona and Bubby trying to eat each other. I don't know. I mean, the answer is like, it's crazy that the audience is global, and that something like On the Trail of Bigfoot comes out and has literally millions of views. But at the same time, I want the audience to get bigger. I still just keep wanting to get this stuff in front of as many people as we can. And when we have something like Momo come out that I'm really proud of and consider sort of an artistic or creative high point for us, and it doesn't find an audience, it's all the more painful for me. Yes. Because we put so much, like, I think that's what separates us from something like, you know, like some of the big network production houses, the companies that like put out TV shows like Ancient Aliens or whatever, you know, like that's just a random thing, but any kind of like network, those are giant corporation run production companies, and there's hundreds if not thousands of people that are employed by them. There's a certain level of this is just business to it, whereas with us, like, every single production is so much is poured into it that when you have a project like Momo come out and not find an audience, really it's like a knife through your heart. And it's, on some level, it has a lot to do with the business side of it. And like, because if we have a failure, it's harder for us to continue surviving. But it's more like with Momo especially, it's more about we just wanted that movie to find an audience because we really think it's something special. I still do. Like, I had to run through it the other day because I was trying to grab production stills for something. And, you know, I was like skimming through it real quick. And as I was doing it, I was like, I really like this movie. I hope someday, like, it becomes some sort of like cult favorite or something, like, because it was an original approach, I think, to that story. And I'm not tooting my own horn. I'm just really proud of all the work everyone did. So, yeah, I can't remember what your initial question was. I started just rambling about Momo.
No, as you should, man. Momo was one of my favorites so far. I remember reviewing it, and I think you're right. I think it is. It's definitely one of your it's your unicorn. You know, it's that special one that I think
it's super weird.
Yeah, and it'll get its day. I have no doubt. But you know, kind of the real reason we have you here, besides the inception of Small Town Monsters, is to talk about On the Trail of UFOs. So my obvious question next is, what made you want to finally cover UFOs, and what was your approach with this project?
Yeah, I think in 2017 is when we hit on the idea for On the Trail of and doing the sort of episodic series stuff. And you know, Alexander Petikoff did On the Trail of Champ, and I really enjoyed his approach to it, and I liked how scaled back it was and how much of a return to or the early days of STM it was, where it was more about, like, the travel and the adventure side of the filmmaking and less about, like, let's make a crazy-looking movie, you know, which is what we do now. It's like we approach everything really cinematically and methodically, and a film production is very different from On the Trail of, which Shannon kind of witnessed firsthand in LA when we were filming On the Trail of UFOs. And then it, like, midway through had to shoot two interviews, one for the Mothman Legacy and one for the Mark of the Bell Witch. And everything changes. It becomes very like how the lighting is set up. And it takes us like 30 minutes to get one light in the right position and all that kind of stuff. It's just a very different vibe from On the Trail. So I really wanted to get back.
He actually made me stand on my head so that I could hold a light with my feet because it was at the perfect angle. So I had to hold that position for over an hour.
Yeah.
Damn, your triceps must be huge. Really,
oh, dude. Burn it. It still burns, but it was worth it. We got the shot.
Yeah. So we did On the Trail of Bigfoot, which was the first On the Trail of that I did. And it was like all filmed and shot by me, other than maybe like a few points here and there where I was on camera and someone else would hold the camera. And while we were working on that, we did something with Shannon. We did a shoot with Shannon. Now my dog's knocking on the door. get away. Stop. We did a shoot with Shannon and we had a blast while we were doing it. And I wanted to have a chance to go, you know, do more of that, to get back out in the woods and have her involved, because we had a lot of fun and we've known each other since 2014 when we had met online before that. But in 2014, we met on a town hall meeting for Finding Bigfoot.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
That's how we met face to face. So we had a blast doing the Adams County thing for On the Trail of Bigfoot. And then I also hated being on the camera and running the camera with On the Trail of Bigfoot. And I thought it'd be a perfect kind of opportunity to bring Shannon in and put her in as like our POV character and let her hog the screen. So that's pretty much it.
Cool.
That's it.
Well, that kind of bleeds into my next question, Shan. How did you get involved and what was it like? You know, I'm sure you had seen some of Seth's work before that and talked online, but what was it like actually becoming like a member of the Small Town Monsters family?
Well, and you said the exact proper word that I always use, and it really is a family. And we spend a lot of time with each other, especially on this last shoot, to where, I mean, if there was any kink in the armor, it would really show up very quickly. And I don't think that things would run as smoothly as they do. And we really truly do love each other. We have a blast. And yeah, everybody ribs the other one, and you know, we're dropping F-bombs and all, you know, like half the day. I think we must go through about 100 of those. Sorry, everybody who is maybe slightly offended by that, but it's just one of our things. I don't know.
Yeah, so it tells me my audience will be okay with that.
Yeah, probably. And I know that mine would be too, but you know, and I know that this bugs Seth, but I always say it. I still, to this day, one of my favorite productions of his is still Minerva Monster. I loved that film. When I first saw it, I always told him, I was like, dude, you're going places. You just wait, you know? And he's like, to this day, he's like, oh no, that's the last one that you should be in love with, you know, is Minerva Monster. Yeah. Yeah. But you know, to be invited to be such a big part, especially for this round for On the Trail UFOs. And by the way, On the Trail of Bigfoot for me almost didn't even happen because I was literally at the airport and I was going to board like an hour and a half from that time. I get an alert on my phone that the alarm at my home is going off, and I frantically am calling ADT and I'm like, please just go over there. And, you know, if nothing's wrong, I'll shut it off and I'll get on this plane and be on my merry way to go film this documentary. And they're like, well, maybe, you know, so I ended up leaving and missing my flight. And long story short, I was up for a really long time because Seth rebooked me a flight. And I was able to get out that night, but the second I got in, we hit the road. So I don't know how I was still in a great mood, but well, actually, I do know how. It's because this group of people, to swing back to the original question, they're amazing, and I feel extremely blessed to be a part of that family. And we really,
you
truly
had not
are.
Slept though.
No, I didn't sleep.
Because you flew, you took a red eye out, but it wasn't like a typical red eye because you got in at like 4 a.m. or something crazy.
Yeah,
like it was 4:30. Yeah, you got into Cleveland. And then we got back to my house, and then we all hopped in the car and drove to Adams County and then went out filming. By the time you got into bed, you'd been up for like 30 hours or something.
Yeah, but it's so weird because when I think back on that, if I was to do that right now, from right now and, you know, add it up to 36 hours, I would be ripping heads off people and I would be the biggest bitch on the planet. But I don't know. There's something about just, you know, and also, you know, you are working. I mean, you're taking it seriously, obviously, but I don't know. I was tired by the end of it. I remember sitting at dinner going, I may actually yak my dinner up. I don't know. I think we were sitting at the Mexican restaurant there, and I was like, I think I need to go to sleep or something. I don't know what's going on. But yeah, it was still an amazing trip, and I'm really glad that it worked out for me to be there. But it almost didn't. That was kind of one of the backstories that I think that a lot of people didn't know. I think that maybe just a bird hit the window, you know, and a dummy bird outside, and the alarm went off and it sent the alert to my phone because nothing was. Oh, and it was also Christmas time. So I'm thinking, oh, somebody broke in and all the Christmas presents, you know, all these things are going through your mind. I'm like, I'm so sorry, Seth. I got to go home and see what's going on. These a-holes at ADT that I pay for are not going to go over and see if anything's actually broken. So, yeah. Anyway, long story short, made it out. And now the On the Trail UFOs is, of course, something that I am very proud to be a part of.
Yeah, I mean, we all know, Shen, you come sort of from the world of Bigfoot. I mean, this is where you got your start. This is what most of your initial research started with. So when Seth approached you to cover UFOs, like, what was that like? Did he have any trepidation, or were you, like, all in from the beginning? What was that like?
Oh, yeah, I was definitely all in.
Didn't we talk about... I think we talked about it that weekend, the weekend you were actually up here for Adams County. I think we were already talking about it even that far in advance, which actually wasn't that far in advance. It was like a few months before we would have started shooting. But I think we actually discussed it while she was here filming Bigfoot.
Yeah, because I remember you, and he does say this a lot. He's always like, I can't stand being on camera, which I never understood. I mean, you know, but everybody feels like that about your own voice or the way you look, or we're all like that. Yeah. But yeah, we did talk about it, and I was like, of course, I would love to do that. I mean, UFOs is not my wheelhouse in any way, shape, or form. I'm terrible with like, oh, well, this case happened on this date, and this is the exact location of it, and that's so not my strong suit, but it's obviously something that I do like to cover on my show occasionally as well when it comes up, of course.
So, okay, so with On the Trail of UFOs, guys, Seth, you have, you sort of have this core group that you work with. I know you bring people in and out of several different projects, but, could you maybe tell us a little about the crew on the Trail of UFOs before we get into the meat of the actual journey? Who was a part of this, and who did your artwork, I have to ask? These posters and marketing images you guys have been cranking out are so cool. So, yeah, I always like to get the creatives credit on these things.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
are the forgotten people often who don't get the credit they deserve.
This one was totally different from On the Trail of Bigfoot, because like I said, On the Trail of Bigfoot was really – the crew was like a one-man crew, and it was pretty much me. And most of that was because of the way we were doing the shoot, where On the Trail of Bigfoot cost less than $5,000 to make, and that's with our poster budget.
Wow.
Most of that is because of the fact that I tacked on my shooting trips to trips I was already taking. So if I was going to San Francisco to speak and show movies at Bigfoot Bonanza, I tacked on an extra 2 days and went up into the Muir Woods and shot B-roll and interviewed Lauren Coleman and whoever else I could find in San Francisco that was willing to do an interview. And that's how it was. Like I would do an event and I would also tack on an interview and B-roll. And that's how we got all the footage, and that's how I got to so many different locations. We actually hit more states with On the Trail of Bigfoot than we did with On the Trail of UFOs. But that was the crew on that was non-existent. And with On the Trail of UFOs, it was very different. But the crew did change somewhat. Not change, I guess, like there were additions. There weren't really any subtractions other than we lost Brandon for the East Coast leg of the trip. So Jason Udis was who is normally our sound recordist with On the Trail of UFOs. We didn't use a boom mic once. All the audio is actually either in camera or lav mics. So Jason was actually pretty much just like a secondary camera guy and held either a handy cam, or I'd just hand him whatever and he'd shoot as like a secondary camera. Zach Palmisano was along for the East Coast trek. Brandon was there. Shannon was there, obviously. Adam Dugan was a part of the East Coast trek. So was Alexander Petikov. And am I missing someone, Shannon?
I'm trying to think. I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah. And everyone kind of added their own, helped in some way. I don't really know, like, unlike the movies, I don't know what to credit people with. Cause people, I mean, mm-hmm. the cinematography in the opening credits, it says Zach, Seth and Jason when it is giving the cinematography credit. But the fact is, like, Zach, Jason and I shot large chunks of the series, but I think Shannon has cinematography in there as well, like stuff she nice. Shot that made it in. So did Adam, so did Alex. So everyone kind of did something, and the crew was varied and changed a lot. So it was very different from the last On the Trail of. As far as like the poster art, so our poster art is done by Matt Pepler, who did On the Trail of Bigfoot as well. He does those like double exposure looking artistic. They're like minimalist posters, but I loved his style. And it's funny how I met Matt. We were at Wizard World back in 2015, Wizard World Cleveland, the Comic-Con. And I saw his table, but he wasn't at his table. And I took his business card and didn't contact him until 2018 when we were making Bigfoot, and that was the first time I spoke to him. So it took a few years, but I had always followed him and really liked his work and wanted to work with him at some point. So he does the posters, and then I have to give a ton of credit to Mark Randall for doing like 97 illustrations that are featured throughout the series. He did an astronomical amount of work between the first work he turned in was in December. So let that sink in, because that means he did 90 plus pieces between December and when we locked cut at the very end of January.
Oh my God. So that's like a full-time job.
Yeah. Yeah. He did boatloads of artwork, and I think it's fantastic. I've already brought him on to do more for the Mothman project that were the
on the Trail of the Lake Michigan Mothman project that we're working on now too. So he's, yeah, his work in there is great. Santino Vitale ended up doing a ton of effects work, which was not part of the original plan. This was, you know, on the Trail of, supposed to be scaled back. It's not supposed to have recreations and all that kind of stuff. And then UFOs completely bucked the system that I had kind of had in place in my head for what things were going to be like. So Santino did a ton of effects work. I mean, episode 6, which is the Mystery Lights, that episode has more effect shots in it than all of, I think, Invasion on Chestnut Ridge. But that one 27-minute episode is loaded with effect shots. And it's not all Santino. I actually learned how to do some effects work myself. So
ooh,
I did
nice.
I did effect shots throughout the series too. So, yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anyone else that I need to. Well, the sound design and sound editing on our last few movies and now this miniseries have been done by John Parfit, who we brought on board with Terror in the Skies. And he did a ton of work, as you can imagine, with this one, especially when you see the all the like crazy quick cuts and stuff like that. He's adding those camera whirring noises and like, oh, wow, when there's like the weird zooms and all that. That's all John doing all that work. So that stuff was John's. And then obviously the opening theme is done by Brandon Dalo, who has now done that. That's a variation on what we're calling the On the Trail of theme, which is actually a song that was in the Beast of Whitehall called In the Valley. He reworked it for On the Trail of Bigfoot. Now he reworked it again for On the Trail of UFOs. So
I love it. So we've got an On the Trail theme song going.
Yeah.
That's awesome, man. All right. Well, let's get to chapter one, the UFO people. I'd love to sort of cover each episode here with you guys. Briefly, we don't want to give away too much, but it sort of introduces us to the people in ufology, and it brings us up to date on the big story that broke in 2017, New York Times, blah, blah, blah. If my audience doesn't know that by now, they are not UFO people. But yeah, we got the secret Pentagon UFO program and all that. So could you maybe tell us, the both of you, maybe a little about why you decided to choose to begin the series this way? And maybe a little about why you chose the people you did to interview throughout the whole series?
Shannon can definitely talk about the interviews. I knew from the beginning this was the first episode. In fact, like, this was part of the initial episode layout. It's funny because this is typically where an SDM project would end, especially, you know, something like On the Trail of Bigfoot was very chronological, sort of began with the past and brought us up to the present. I did not want to do that with On the Trail of UFOs. I wanted it to be sort of all over the place chronologically. It's about the phenomenon itself rather than the history. As sort of the, it's about the history, but the history is interspersed with all this other stuff, and you know, the history is going to be dulled out as you're learning about all these different subtopics of the genres, as we called it in one of the episodes. Mm-hmm. So beginning with this was really important because our main audience, the reason we exist, the reason Small Town Monsters exists, is our audience is a general audience. It's Bigfooters are great. UFO people are great. That is not the audience that is watching our movies in the millions. You know, like, it just doesn't compute. I don't think there's that many people that are avidly into these topics. So whenever we make anything, our core, the audience that we are making stuff for is an audience who might not be aware of a lot of the ins and outs of these topics. So beginning with an episode that sort of helped set the stage for where ufology is today was super important. And at the same time, getting a really sort of intense personal story in the form of Dan Weiss's encounter was equally important because it helped establish the tone of what we were going for throughout the rest of the series. And it sort of helped set the mission statement that we had from the beginning as well, which was, you know, we're going to put the focus back on the people that are involved in this. So that's from a storytelling standpoint, this was always the opening episode.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah.
And as far as like the interviews go, we went after people who were interesting from a witness standpoint, and we went after people who were skilled and knowledgeable on UFOs, but a lot of that had had to do with Shannon, because Shannon set a lot of these up.
Oh, sure. Yeah, Shannon, I'll throw it to you. Yeah. What made you choose these people?
I mean, as you know, just a byproduct of doing a show like this, even if you're not heavy into UFOs, you still know a lot of UFO people. And I was lucky enough to get a hold of a lot of these folks, and they were on board with talking to us. And, you know, we contacted and sat down and covered everything from, you know, we've got a historian in there. We've got a NASA engineer in there. We've got plenty of experiencers and witnesses of craft, and, you know, even down to beings and things that they think that they've seen and experienced in their own homes. And then even somebody that, you know, likes to execute the more the CE5 kind of thing, you know, where you're going out and you've got almost this kind of a kata, like a dance that they're doing to try to call a craft in, basically. And, you know, that's the space that they live in. So we had such a cross section, and I love this word, a dichotomy of different types of people that were, I mean, on completely different ends of the spectrum. And, you know, in hindsight, to take even this person and that person or these three people and just to let them start to chat on camera would have been an amazing part of the series if that was logistically possible to do. But it is such a different cross section in just these 8 episodes. It's very mind blowing, and it was very humbling for me to be a part of it, to realize how different people are, but they're still kind of going after the same thing. Obviously, so they still want to know. They're still asking the very same questions that no matter what you believe, that we all are.
Yeah, well, you bring up a good point, Shannon. You know, full disclosure to the audience, I do make appearances in this series, but when I was sitting there talking with you guys, I felt like I was just rambling, and like nothing I said made sense, none of it was chronological. I left being like, what the hell did I just say? And then when you see the series in a context and this overall narrative that you guys crafted about the UFO topic, it's amazing when you can zoom out and see all these different perspectives put into one cohesive narrative. You know, maybe it's not as clean and neat as most people want the UFO topic to be, but that's just it. It never is. But it was really cool and refreshing to see so many different people talking about UFOs. And even though we disagree on things, the core elements were there, and we all had so much more in common than I ever thought we could. So that was really cool.
Seth, did you tell him? Did you tell him yet, Seth? How you feel about his interview?
Oh, yeah. I think I did while we were doing it, but your interview was my favorite. Like I said this, I think I said it while we were there, but that was the most relaxed I was during any of the interviews. And, you know, maybe it's because we kind of have known each other. I mean, we'd never met before, but we'd known each other for a few years now.
Yeah, I felt like I'd known you my whole life.
Yeah, I mean, it was so relaxed, and it came at a really, I said this on another show recently, it came at a really necessary time for me, because Shannon and I were both sick. Shannon was getting sicker. I was getting better by then. But
yeah, because you started it, and he was the host.
Yeah, so I was the host.
He was over it, and all of us were like,
patient zero. Let's not get into viruses.
I was completely exhausted from like driving 2 days.
Oh, yeah.
Doing all the filming the day before. I was sort of stressed out. And that interview like really put me at ease at a very early point in the trip where I still had a lot of work ahead of me. So it was like, it was weirdly therapeutic in a way too, because it reminded me of why I like doing interviews. It didn't have the formality of some of the other ones that we had done and were about to do. So that was one of my favorite, if not my favorite interview on the entire shoot.
Oh, shucks. Well, that's good to hear, man. And then I threw you to the wolves in the middle of Times Square.
That was great, though.
That was fun. That was
a blast. Yeah, and that's some of my favorite footage in the entire series, was following you guys around Times Square, which is funny. That originally, you know, that the footage of you guys walking around was going to be in the first episode, and then I wanted to use it in the second one, and then third, because it's like some of my favorite footage. And then it ended up not making it until the very end, like till the beginning of episode 8, it finally, the Times Square footage finally shows up.
Yep. Times Square always making its late entrance, I guess, in fashion. I was so honored to be a part of this, and I love the way you did this. It was so unique to what we usually see in the UFO world. These, like, you know, super slick documentaries that have the same damn people in them spouting the same stuff in an echo chamber. But that's not what we got here. And what I loved is each sort of episode has its own facet to UFOs. And I always tell people, you know, the UFO topic can be viewed from every angle you can possibly think of, whether it's history, you know, psychology, biology, anthropology, psychology, everything. And that's why that's what I've always loved about UFOs. So when we get to Chapter 2, The Changing Face, this is where you kind of cover the craft themselves, which, you know, is a nuts and bolts approach to ufology, which a lot of the old school people seem to focus on a lot, is the evolution of the phenomenon or these craft that people are seeing. So, yeah, what was it like trying to really get across this point in the series of how UFOs have changed throughout the, I guess, the decades?
It's funny. My concern with this episode was that people would find this super boring, but something like the airship waves is one of my favorite aspects of ufology. Like those airship waves have always been really fascinating to me. And Mark and I actually did I think we did two parts on Monsteropolis that were all about the airships earlier this year. And, so yeah, it was really important to establish what a UFO is for an audience, as stupid as that might sound, but for an audience that is just coming into this, that thinks of UFOs solely as being a flying saucer like they've seen in movies from like the 1940s, because for a lot of people that's what a UFO is, or it's just the Tic Tac now, because like that's a thing, like people are just coming into this because they saw the Tic Tac video and they're interested because Tom DeLonge is into UFOs now. And so I wanted to establish, like, right out of the gate, like, this is what a UFO is. This is, you know, like, the entire thing's been changing. What they are is changing almost daily, it seems like. But at the same time, there are these waves of, like, particular types of craft. So, you know, starting with the airships and then working our way to, like, the black triangles was really fun. And then it also gave me a chance to start looking at how much we were going to do. And interestingly enough too, episode 2 was actually edited before episode 1. So that quick cut kind of style was established on episode 2 rather than episode 1. We had not finished shooting episode 1 because we had not done the Los Angeles trip yet. And, I was waiting on Greg Bishop's interview because I knew that was going to be used in episode 1. So episode 2 was actually the first finished episode of On the Trail of UFOs. And so that ended up being the episode that established the style and tone stylistically, the entire series going forward. But it was really important to set up what a UFO is. I don't know if Shannon wants to, she was along for the blueprinting of all this too. So she can talk about that some.
Yeah. Do you have anything to add, Shannon?
No, I mean, you know, Seth usually covers everything so beautifully. And we found out on the last show that one of our answers is exactly the same for a very important question. So, no, I think that, unlike Seth, though, I think that the airships, although they are very interesting, I think for me, the old school flying saucers, the Kenneth Arnold, the nuts and bolts, I still just love that stuff so much. And the idea that, you know, hopefully there are little gray men flying these things. I still have that romantic view of it. Of course, it's not so romantic to those that think they bust into their homes and stick things inside them. But that's not just saying that, you know, to be slight. But I still want that to be true. I don't want to think that human beings, although I know that we are intelligent, that we could actually create such things even way back then that could make maneuvers like that. So, I like the fact that also in this we talk about everything. We cover everything. We wanted to make sure that, as Seth said, if you're just coming into this and you want a good broad base of UFOs, we made sure to do that for them.
I guess using Phoenix as the bookend was kind of important too, because Phoenix is such an important modern day event. And at the same time, like, I remember being really paranoid. I don't know if we talked about this on the shoot. I think we did. I think I was really paranoid about using Phoenix because of the fact that it seems like it's so covered, you know, like it's been covered so much in popular media. And at the same time, when I really, and when I stepped back and thought about it, I was like, I actually don't know that it's as well known as it should be to an audience that's just coming into UFOs, you know? Right. So like, and maybe for an existing audience, for the existing ufology people, like you've got Ron Regier talking about seeing it on that radar coming out of Area 51 or whatever, which I don't think was out there before we did this. That's so there's insane. At least something new in there.
That like blew my mind when he said that. 'Cause you know, we all have these, at least within the UFO community, these romantic ideas of, you know, Phoenix Lights was this. It was two events. The first was alien. The second was a military cover-up. But to hear someone like Ron say that, oh, we saw that on radar at Area 51, like, that completely blew my mind. Yeah, that was so cool. Okay, so we go from the craft to the places in Chapter 3. Now, the places you will go, this episode really, really fascinated me. It put into perspective how important area and geography can actually be when researching UFOs. And you covered stuff like the Hudson Valley or, you know, Pennsylvania or even Sedona, Arizona, which is said to be, you know, these big hotspots or quote unquote window areas for UFOs. So what was it like exploring this aspect of UFOs?
It was, again, like this was like part of the initial breakdown for episodes even before we'd filmed it. So we knew, I knew I wanted to hit this. I think I thought the episode would play out a little differently than how it ended up playing out. But I like the layout of the episode and how it jumps from between these. I think it's three specific areas where it really spends time. But I mean, there's Skinwalker Ranch is talked about in this episode. There's a lot of different spots that are mentioned, but it was really important to me because of Hudson Valley. The Hudson Valley stuff is some of my favorite UFO wave. Yeah, you know, it's so amazing because there were so many people involved, and it seems like it's so underrepresented these days. Like people don't talk about it as much as they once did, and I always loved this because of that Unsolved Mysteries episode where they did the amazing recreation of like the Black Triangle going over the dude's house in like some suburban neighborhood in the Hudson Valley. And I'm obsessed with the Hudson Valley. We're actually talking about like going back on another vacation because we actually went to the Hudson Valley as like a family vacation last year. And we're talking about doing it again because I love the area and I love how New England-y it feels, but it still feels completely different. It feels like – I don't know what it is about that area, but – I mean, Ryan, you're close to that area, so I'm sure you know what I mean. It just feels different. It feels – otherworldly or something. There's something about it I really like.
Absolutely. It's just there's something magnetic about it. I mean, you know, growing up in upstate New York, like you'd be surprised. I actually never really made it to the Hudson Valley until I moved to New York City. And it took moving to this crazy city to, like, you know, start exploring my state overall. And then, you know, just going to these areas where you hear that this UFO wave happened. Not even, it might not even be the UFOs themselves, but it's the lore behind it when you get to these places and you start feeling it. It's magical. It is.
And this is also kind of like for the East Coast trip, this was the first time it felt like we were really, this episode, something we filmed for this episode is when it I first felt like we were really doing it on the trail of series was when we did the Kecksburg stuff. 'Cause it was, it was a callback. It just felt like I was back on the trail of Bigfoot. 'Cause we're out in the dark and Stan Gordon's there and we're looking at lights in the sky where it's painfully obvious they're airplanes, but nonetheless,
that doesn't matter.
Yeah, it didn't matter. We were, and I wanted to do an episode too that really set up that idea of window areas, hotspots, flaps, you know, like stuff like that. And again, like there's a big importance to the overall. That's a huge piece of the overall puzzle.
Also, another piece of our puzzle in Pennsylvania at the Chestnut Ridge was we stayed at a house that we actually had Moe's there on property, like staying in a smaller house off of our house. But Seth and I and Adam, we go walking up the hill to get little night shots and this and that. And dude just runs out of our basement.
Oh my God, our basement, not his.
I'm like, where did Mose come from? What the hell is he doing over there?
There was a man on site who came out of our basement at like midnight. I mean, it was very random.
Did you ever find out why?
No, it wasn't just him. It was like him and his wife, and there was someone else too. They were taking like a mattress out the second time we saw him.
This place had a kill room like in Dexter. Yeah. We aren't kidding. God. There was a damn kill room in the back with, you know, you got the sawhorses with the plastic all over. Yeah. And there were other things that happened at that house that night. But,
yeah, some people, some disembodied at like 5 a.m. might have been earlier. I woke up and, very clearly heard someone walk up the back porch, because this is an old house, probably built in the 1800s. Actually, it was older than that. Isn't it, Shannon? Didn't we find something that said it was like the oldest house in the state or something?
It was insane. Yeah, and it had like this log book, and people were talking about the ghosts in there.
People were talking about all the ghosts in the house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, 5 a.m., let me set this part up, because this is funny. So the way the house is laid out is the bedrooms are all upstairs, and but there's two sleeping areas. So one sleeping area is a bedroom that you have to go up this creepy flight of steps that's insanely narrow and tall, and you go up and there's one bed, and that was where Shannon slept
all by then myself.
In the other side of the house, isolated section of the house. Wow. And then in the other section of the house is two bedrooms and then like an open area with two beds in it. And that's all in one small tiny area. And that's where all the men were. That's where we're all sleeping. So we're all like safely in our little like hut or whatever on one end, and then Shannon's in another section of the house entirely.
Oh, yeah. You weren't on the insurance, Shan. Sorry.
Yeah. No, not at all.
It's like 5 a.m. I wake up and I hear footsteps come up our back porch, the deck of the house. I hear the back door open. I hear the back door, the screen door open. I hear the back door open. I hear the screen door close. I hear the back door close. I hear footsteps come through our kitchen and go into what sounded like the living room. I'm out of bed immediately because we have thousands of dollars worth of equipment sitting downstairs. I out of bed immediately. I get Adam. Adam's out of bed. We run downstairs. There's no one. There's no one in the bed. There's no one downstairs. We go through, we check the door. The doors are all locked. There's no one in the kitchen. The basement door, you can't really access through there. So I don't know what I heard, but I very clearly heard someone walking.
Because you weren't even asleep, right? You were up.
I was wide awake.
You were awake at that point. This is not like you dreamed this and then you went downstairs.
Oh, yeah. On shoots, I really don't sleep very well on a shoot, which is probably why I have migraines pretty much the entire time we're filming. But yeah, I was wide awake at that point. So I was just laying there waiting to get up so I could go film and we could head to New York City, because later that day, Ryan, was actually when we interviewed you.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. Wow.
So I don't know what it was, but that house was haunted. Wow.
Haunted as hell. So yeah. The logbook actually did mention that in various places, several places.
So
enjoy the haunted house. Cool right. spot. You're like, oh God.
You went looking for UFOs and you found a ghost. Way to go,
and
guys.
Also, and Seth has a knack for finding Airbnbs that only have one bathroom, like, and that's down in like the common area. So nobody felt like they could take a proper poop like the entire trip, you know. Even the New York Airbnb where you got interviewed, the bathroom's like right in the living room. Basically.
Yeah. You know what? The best thing about that was I woke up from my nap right before Ryan got there, and there was no one in that house. You guys had all left me.
So happy.
I took a nap prior to Ryan's arrival. I woke up, everyone's gone. I'm like, I got this whole place to myself.
Yeah, time to do it. See, this is the inside scoop, the things that people don't get to hear about.
Hear the term proper poop on this episode, huh, guys? Well, you did.
That might have to be the title of the episode. We'll see.
Can I get a proper poop on these sheets? Come on.
Oh, man. Okay, so we move from window areas to locations to the Tricksters. I love the title of this episode. And this is where you start digging into what could be behind the UFOs in terms of an intelligence or what it is. So you got a lot of – you got a wide spectrum of opinions and theories on this from the people you interviewed. So what did you both make of what you discovered in this aspect of the research? Who are piloting these damn UFOs?
Warning, if you like your UFO literature to confirm what you already know, this is not the book for you. From White Crow Books comes a brand new collection of essays, 14 authors, one goal, to shatter the UFO topic and pick up the pieces in a whole new light. Compiled and edited by Robbie Graham, with a foreword by Professor Diana Walsh-Pasulka, UFOs Reframing the Debate is a cold, hard slap in the face for ufology, delivered with love. UFOs Reframing the Debate. Available now in paperback and ebook on Amazon and at Barnes & Noble, the Book Depository, and the iBooks Store. For a complete list of contributors and to learn more, visit robbiegraham.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
UK.
Oh. Well, I mean, I already told you I wanted it to be the Greys. So,
yeah.
You know, but I think at this point, unfortunately, sorry to jump in, Seth, but just real quick, I have a quick answer. I think a lot of the stuff that we're seeing, especially now, is in fact us. But in fact, my stepbrother, Sean Kevin Jason, you know him very well, Ryan. You know, he's admitted that the triangle craft that he saw, he really feels like that was piloted by people. Now, where the tech came from, of course, that's a whole roundabout chasing the tail answer. You know, did it come from the Greys or something else or something off planet? But I mean, of course, I want it to be something ET. I think that would be amazing.
Yeah. What do you think, Seth?
What do I personally think? I have no idea. But yeah, the
that's a good answer. That's the answer I was looking for.
but the episode is. One thing I can say about this episode, these haven't come out yet, so I'm supposed to really be selling these. So everyone watch it. This episode's great. It's my least favorite of the entire series.
Oh, good salesperson right there.
Hey, he's an honest filmmaker. I like it.
Having said that,
it's not because I think the episode's solid. I think I like the fact that we have a native perspective in it. I like the fact that you kind of get a broad spectrum of different opinions on what is going on. So it has nothing to do with the content of the episode. I just kind of find this aspect of the whole thing boring. Like honestly, I don't think we know what is piloting the UFOs, and I don't think we know if some of them are being piloted by anything. And I, you know, like, it's just such a, as weird as that seems, that is not like the topic of all of this that really draws me in. And also, like, I didn't, this episode was mostly edited by Luke Gall. So this was the episode where episode 3 and episode 4 had an assistant editor, my friend Luke Gall, and he did a lot of the editing on this one. But that has nothing to do with why it's not.
Poor
yeah,
Luke.
Yeah, sure. You just it's dropped the ball on that. That just came right out.
It honestly just comes down to the topic not being my favorite.
So yeah, what is your favorite aspect out of any of it then? What does draw you in?
Well, see, like what draws me in and what my favorite episode or whatever are completely different.
No, yeah. But what just the subject itself? What draws you in the most?
Well, the mystery light thing is my favorite. And I don't know if that's, again, I don't know if you can include that as UFOs. So if it's not that, it's probably going to be my typical answer of like the historical, historical
cases. Like, I'm just kidding. No,
you know, the early like 1940s is my favorite era of ufology, or the late 1940s is my favorite era of ufology. And so like it's that stuff. It's the Cold War era.
I mean, it ramped up so much in the 40s and 50s that the, the government got involved, Project Blue Book and all that good stuff. So no, that makes complete sense.
One thing I do have to say I adore about this episode is the opening and the bookends. I love that it opens with Exeter. I love Exeter. I loved that Joe Hill lived there and I didn't know it until after we were there. Mm-hmm. And I love the stuff with Shannon on the beach at the end walking, because that sunset was unfreaking believable. And
we took so much footage of that sunset. Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And I just liked the way all that came together with her in the location in Exeter, kind of talking to the people, all of us really talking to the people about, you know, like where the actual Exeter event happened. It's a different opening from any of the other episodes too, because it opens with a witness story, not that the witness was there, but it opens with a UFO story and then goes into like what the actual topic of the episode is. So the fact that this is my least favorite has nothing to do with the actual content of the episode. I really like the episode as a whole, and I love that the Exeter stuff especially, and I love Malava's interview. I have to say I really having that perspective in there is really important. The one downside to that is his interview was like an hour and a half, and his interview is distilled into 3 minutes. Right. And you know, like if he watches that, he's probably going to hate it, because obviously to boil down what he thinks, and this is part of the narration says to boil down like to distill, you know, what his belief system is about UFOs into like one tiny little chunk is almost impossible. Mm-hmm. But he had so much to say about that stuff and the origins of not just the UFOs, but like the ant people and all that kind of stuff. I hope we can use more of that in an interview if we can do a season two, because that his interview is really cool.
Yeah, I loved getting that native perspective. It's super important. I mean, some of our greatest stories of the Star People and all these sorts of things come from the Native Americans, and I'm digging a lot deeper into that in future episodes of Somewhere in the Skies too. So I'm so happy that you were able to do that and get that perspective of it, because it's very important, I think, when it comes to the overall phenomenon. And this is my favorite episode, guys. Chapter 5, The Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. This is where we get to the dark and sexy government cover-up angle to all this. And we tackle Area 51, military involvement. So what surprised you two the most about covering this aspect of UFOs? And do you have any sort of personal thoughts on which things are clearly a cover-up and what was just sort of maybe born out of a mythology, I guess?
Shannon, you start.
You're going to throw me in this one, huh?
Yeah.
No,
You're our Area 51 expert. Come on.
Yeah, for real.
Yeah, right? Since it's just right in my backyard. Yep, you know, since I see UFOs every day since I'm in Vegas, that's the go-to right there. Never seen one, really, actually, except for the orb in Washington State. So there you go. So as far as Area 51 goes, just in general, I don't think anything would surprise me either way. If all of it was man-made, okay, that makes sense. Or if all of it was alien craft, which would be amazing, but that also would not be that surprising. See, UFOs in and of themselves, it's going to sound really stupid, but they're almost they're not boring to me. They're just, they're like, yeah, I totally get it. And it makes sense. And how could we be the only things out there? So, I mean, something like a Bigfoot or a Dogman, especially a Dogman, don't get me started on that, but a Wolfman, those are really like kind of crazy cool to me. UFOs make so much sense that maybe that's why I don't cover them so much on Into the Fray. But as far as Area 51 goes, the thing that chases its tail so much out there is the fact that, you know, you had something like the Blackbird out there at one point, you know, sitting on top of a huge spike. I know I've told this with you on Ryan before. It's one of my favorite stories out of 51. Mm-hmm. They would bring it out during the day and they'd be doing the testing on it. And it was up on this massive pole. And then they'd take it in. Or I'm sorry, they'd bring it out at night, but the desert was still, the heat from the day would still be basically give the outline of the Blackbird underneath it. They would take it in and think they were so sneaky. Meanwhile, the Russian satellites go over and they see the exact basically cutout of the Blackbird and they know exactly what the hell we were working on. So, you know, that makes you kind of go, are we really that smart? Are we really smart enough to be coming up with something like a TR-3B, which we do have, which Sean has admitted that he thinks that's probably what he saw that day outside of Area 51 or that night. But I think that where the tail chasing, sorry, I said this earlier, where this comes from is the fact that people go, well, there is man-made stuff. Well, yeah, sure, but it did this crazy maneuver. Well, how do we get that technology? And then it's chasing its tail as far as, well, did it come from off planet? And now we're just reproducing that. Somehow we have to back engineer that. Or did we actually come up with all of that on our own? So I don't know. I mean, that is the proper question, I think, as far as what's going on out there, really.
I like the idea. Now, this is what I've hit. See, whenever I do an interview, I'm always like, I'm trying to find a hook. So my hook now is going to be, I'm going to let Shannon talk about the actual stuff you're asking, and I'm just going to ramble about like filmmaking stuff. So this episode,
this is why you guys make such a good team.
this episode is my favorite of the series, actually, because the opening is so unique from anything else that's come in anything STM. It feels more like an action movie or Ferris Bueller. I called it my Ferris Bueller opening because it's like Shannon is very much breaking the fourth wall, and it gets really meta at the beginning. And also our guy that did the color on the entire series had a blast doing this episode because so much of it is in the desert. He created a color palette that he kept in an adjustment layer. He put it on the adjustment layer and it was just called Tony Scott. And it's because the entire episode looks like a Tony Scott movie, like Top Gun or something. Yeah. It looks like a Tony Scott movie. And especially the parts with Shannon at Area 51. So this is my favorite episode. And also I do love the conspiracy and government cover-up angle of ufology. And
is someone
think
on an exercise bike back there? Sorry.
You're hearing that? Yeah, sorry about that. It's in the distance.
you're exercising. I like that. You're killing three birds with one stone. I like it.
No, it's I have a stationary bike in the basement that's like 40 years old, and if either of us use it, it sounds like someone's trying to.
Oh, I was joking. Cradle. It really is an exercise bike.
Oh, it's 100%. Like no, I am dead serious. Thanks for pointing that out.
Sorry. Hey, at least someone's exercising.
Yeah, seriously.
So anyway. Yeah, the actual conspiracy angle of all of this is one of my favorite aspects of the subject. And to get to go to Area 51 and have the insanity that happened as meeting that guy that, you know, we got to interview there and it being the same day that sort of the Area 51 storm, Area 51 stuff blew up and all that. It was insane that happened
to me,
and so as
far as the film aspect of it, I will say, just to add this in, nothing makes you look like more of a badass than slow motion.
That's God, so
you just gotta love it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you guys had some interesting stuff happen when you went there. We'll leave that for the audience to see, because that was pretty exciting. But yeah, that was probably one of my favorites too, Seth. So I totally understand why. Well, then we moved to Chapter 6, Let It Shine. This was pretty cool. This is something I've never really looked into, but I was so happy to see that you guys made it to North Carolina with our mutual friend, Micah Hanks, and you covered the orbs, which is a huge part of ufology that a lot of people don't know about. So yeah, what was it like going to Brown Mountain and, you know, the Marfa lights in Texas you guys covered and several others? So yeah, what was it like actually going out there and doing some sky watching and all that?
Yeah, Shannon, what was it like?
I was, you know, I mean, it's Brown Mountain. I mean, I was extremely expectant and excited. And of course, to meet Micah Hanks was amazing. And yeah, it was a beautiful location. It's funny because even though you've seen footage of the area or you see pictures of the area, until you go there, you know, you're like, oh, this isn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. But it was, I mean, it was more because it was, as far as what he was explaining, there was such a bigger area that you were supposed to be watching. And actually, I think that Seth and I were looking at the wrong place before Micah got there, which was, I mean, these things happen, you know, when you've never been at a place before. It was both of our first times at Brown Mountain. But and Micah's like, oh, no, it's actually over here. We're like, oh, whoopsie. We were off to the left there a little bit. Sorry. But, you know, the whole area there has such mystique to it. And, you know, as far as orbs go, that is something that I have experienced myself. And, you know, we'll have to leave it for the audience to see, you know, what has actually gone down at Brown Mountain for us. But for me, I was super excited to go to that location. And we were very lucky to have Micah take the time to meet us up there on the mountain.
The mystery light thing was a big part of the series for me. I don't know why I was so insistent on getting it in here, because there was other stuff we could have covered. You know, like I don't think we make any, there's no denying the fact that we barely scratched the surface of UFOs with this series, but
welcome,
you know, we had
to my world every day of my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, like if we can do a season two, there's no problem. Like, we can keep doing the same format. It's different from Bigfoot in that way. Like Bigfoot, I had to come up with a completely new format for season two of On the Trail of Bigfoot. But for UFOs, you can keep doing this because there's so much to explore. But mystery lights were a big part of the series for me, and getting to go to Brown Mountain was weird, because it was weird for a couple of reasons. One, I realized while I was there that we were like right down the road from where a good chunk of my family is from. Within like 20, wouldn't you say like 20 minutes, Shannon, where we jumped by?
Yeah. Yes.
So a good chunk of my family, my dad's side of the family, is from there. And then the other thing is, like, I grew up going to a camp in Marion, North Carolina for most of my life. And Marion is there. Like, that is Marion. In fact, Brown Mountain is a Marion zip code. So it was also weird in the fact that Lake James, which is where the camp was that I used to go as a kid, is like right over the mountain from Brown Mountain. So apparently I'd been there most of my life and just never realized that was Brown Mountain.
Wow.
So yeah, we had a lot of fun up there. I think that night was super memorable. And again, like, that felt like sort of classic On the Trail of to me. It felt like we were actually adventuring and doing something cool. And then that episode also has some really neat eyewitness stories. It's got Matt Chang's orb story, and then it's got Greg Cannon's encounter as well. And Greg, I actually shot Greg's interview at an event in Pennsylvania, but I was really excited to get someone in there who'd actually seen the Brown Mountain lights, since Micah has failed to ever see the Brown Mountain lights. So that was important to me as well. But yeah, that was a lot of fun doing that episode. And that episode was also the most draining of all the episodes, because there's so many effect shots. Like I said, there's, my estimate is 40 or 50 effect shots in that episode. And Santino did 12. And I probably did, actually, there's more. There's like 14 of Santino shots in that, but he did 12 specifically for that episode. And then I reused a couple. And I probably did 20 of them myself. Wow. And then there's a bunch of effect shots in there. from other people as well, plus all of Mark Randall's illustrations. That episode is just visually, it is wall to wall effects. And then you get some really cool footage of what might be an actual Brown Mountain Light. So that's cool too.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. Again, this one, yeah, you're right, Seth. It really felt like on the trail when you guys are out there, boots on the ground, experiencing this stuff. So that was super invigorating. Well, then we move to probably one of the most controversial parts of all of this when it comes to UFOs. A lot of researchers shy away from it, and some embrace it entirely, and that's the abduction phenomenon. So can you tell us a little about what and who you explore in this episode, and maybe some of the theories you guys came across when it comes to abductions, what they might represent?
This episode was the hardest to put together from a storytelling standpoint. I have a whiteboard in my office, and you know, for most of the episodes I had to do sort of the classic like arrow, you know, story point to story point. So in my head as I'm editing, it would make sense where each piece of the story needs to go, you know. But in this episode, that changed constantly. And I storyboarded it on as I was editing, and it really was difficult because this episode is the longest. It's 35, it's around 35, 36 minutes, something like that. But I mean, you really get a good overview of what the abduction phenomenon is, and how weird it gets, and how strange some of the theories and stuff are regarding what is behind the actual abductions. And as we were shooting this episode, I did not have any intention of making this a Betty and Barney Hill episode, but it really does end up feeling like a Betty and Barney Hill episode. It definitely has the bookend of being Betty and Barney Hill at the beginning and the end. You know, it's got Shannon and Adam and Alexander talking about them sort of to wrap everything up. And then at the beginning, it's us climbing to the top of Artist Nook, and you get to see some of those video clips of what was Betty's last interview. And a huge thanks to John Horrigan for giving me those clips too and letting us use those, because I think that's kind of a really important piece of the episode, is to have Betty actually on camera talking about the abduction stuff. But I learned a lot in making this episode. I think the thing that stands out the most to me is that some of these experiencers view their abduction as a very positive thing, even when that seems to fly in the face of rational thinking. And the one that really stands out is Gary Tribert's abduction story, where he was driving to get beer one night and saw this light sort of paralleling his car, came around a bend in the road, and there was a car in the middle, or a UFO, a light in the middle of the road, and that's sort of all he remembers. He wakes up 3 hours later, but that's like just the beginning of everything. He's got all this, you know, the physical manifestations, things start happening to him that he doesn't understand. He's waking up with like bloody noses and scoop marks in his neck and all this kind of stuff. And it all sounds terrible. And then it gets to the point where it's happening to his children as well. And yet when we talked to him and asked him about how he felt about it, he didn't seem to think it was negative. And that was so strange to me to sort of wrap my brain around. And Ryan, one thing I have to say about episode 6, just real quick while I'm thinking
of course,
of this.
Man.
Thank you for tying episode 6 back into the UFO subject, because you did it so well, and that freaked me out so bad with episode 6, because I was like, how am I going to even keep this sort of tied into the rest of it? And you and Michael Huntington did such a good job of explaining, like, these are UAPs. Like, this is still a piece of the overall puzzle. So anyway, just one thing of it, I had to mention that.
Oh, you're welcome. I totally meant to do that.
Yeah, I figured.
That's so cool. Yeah, that's what it's about, man. Connecting the dots.
Episode 7 is also visually probably the most stunning of the entire series, because we were filming in the White Mountains at peak, like, fall foliage season. And it's funny because the episode is absolutely, like, stunningly gorgeous, but the subject matter is super disturbing. So I like that weird dichotomy that's going on.
Yeah. Well, Shannon,
dropping the dichotomy. I like
dichotomy twice in one
we
episode.
Just need Ryan to use it before we're done. Then we got the hat trick.
Well, Shannon, what is the dichotomy between what you think abductions are? No.
Oh.
Well, I got to ask, Shannon, you've interviewed experiencers in the past on your show. Mm-hmm. You and I spoke to several from my book on an episode of Into the Fray at one point. I mean, I'm knee-deep in alien abduction experiences, but coming at it from your side of it, what did you make of this episode when it comes to abductions?
I mean, I think that the abduction scenario, and where you go from the classic, like the Strieber kind, to, you know, I recently talked to a woman for ITF that she saw a craft and it seemed to just open up other experiences. Like it just opened the door for her, just like when Seth was talking about Gary Tribert. And, you know, it kind of turns into this thing where there's a tree and then there's lights around the tree and it becomes what she tantamounts as some kind of portal or something. And then this being comes out. Right. And I'm just kind of going to play off of you, Ryan, to see if you've heard anything like this. But she had a name for him because someone else talked. I'm so bad at this UFO stuff. Here I go already. Anyhow, maybe it'll come to you. But this being steps out. She knows it's quote unquote an alien being because it's not human. So it's an alien. And he's wearing a belt of some sort. But there's a light in the middle of this belt. And she gave it a name, and by God, I should have brought that notebook up just in case. But she gave it a name and said, well, I don't think it was so-and-so, but it could have been so-and-so that this person talks about. There's a certain being that comes to people sometimes, and there was really no true interaction or anything, and she didn't see it at all negative. No negative in this story. But the dichotomy of, you know, you have Strieber, but then you have these other experiences where they just, it's like kind of more the light and love crowd, which is sometimes is a four-letter word in and of itself, too. But it is such, like you said, you can get so knee-deep or waist-deep or neck-deep in just the abduction stuff. It is mind-boggling. But, you know, as far as Betty and Barney Hill, the question that came up with a show that Seth and I were also on last week was, you know, what was the location that like blew your mind or whatever? And both of us said Betty and Barney Hill just because of the isolation factor. And even today, if you go out there, it is very isolated. And, you know, without the use of cell phones or feeling like you could really reach out to anyone, no matter what it was, it would be absolutely terrifying to have that experience where you have nowhere to go and you feel like you have something that has ultimate control and you're just in your putt-putt car and you can't go anywhere. And now you have something where you're like, oh, is this, oh, great, an off-planet entity wants to interact with me. This is wonderful. Great. Fantastic. You know, you've got Travis Walton's story, whatever people want to make of any of that stuff. You can go down the list of abductees and be like, well, I don't know what to make of that. And honestly, even Strieber has admitted, you know, he finally said, I don't know what the hell all that was, but whatever it is, does it at the end of the day, though. And this is something, you know, for the episodes that we go through and for this series, it's all down to the people. Like, that's the big picture of the whole thing anyway. So does it even matter if it's people just effing with other people? At the end of the day, the perception of it almost is the most important thing. Or is it grays or something off planet? It's all about the perception and the trauma that the person goes through.
Yep. I mean, I've been preaching this since day one in my research of it does. It comes down to the people and how it affects them and what they take from that. I mean, I think that's where disclosure truly happens. And I'll ask your guys' opinion on disclosure in a little bit. But yeah, I think one by one, the people having UFO experiences, whether it's just a light in the sky or a claimed abduction experience, like it's what you take from that and what you choose to do with it, whether it's never talk about it again or embrace it or start a cult, I don't know, but it's crazy, like, the amount of people that have claimed that this has happened to them, yet we have no solid, verifiable evidence of it being a legitimate physical phenomenon. So you do really have to wonder. I mean, yeah, we come across scoop marks and implants and this, that, but there's no definitive answer as to what these things are, why they're taking people, and yeah, it's scary to me. When people say it's love and light and it was an amazing experience, I find that really hard to believe. I mean, these things are happening against your will time and time again, but again, I've never been abducted, so I can't speak on what someone takes from their own experience, but it's a fascinating subset of the UFO phenomenon, and I'm so happy you guys tackled it, because you had to, let's be honest.
Well, even without the abduction stuff, though, if I saw a being come out a damn tree, belt or no belt, he could be stark nude and be the, you know, looking like Jason Momoa. I don't give a crap. It's not I'm going to freak out. I don't think that I would be like, this is... Yeah, I'm going to sleep great this week. This is going to be amazing. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Good point. Absolutely. Well, we moved to the last episode, Chapter 8, Longer Way to Go. And this one I kind of want to leave for the end of our conversation. But before we do that, guys, I've got some listener questions. Do you mind if I fire through these with you?
Yeah.
Cool. These are going to be fun. You know, kind of rounding out the abduction thing, Cody on Twitter asks, on the topic of abductions, what is the earliest recorded abduction case that you guys came across?
The oldest that we have that seems, if nothing else, at least you have the missing time element, is that 1600s Boston, Massachusetts area story that Dean Merchant tells in the seventh episode.
Oh, awesome.
Where you had the guys rowing down the river and they see what they call sort of like a swine shaped object in the sky, and then they blank out and they've somehow traveled like many miles down this river, and it's hours later. So that's the oldest, like, I guess, missing time case that we came across while we were making this, or abduction case, I guess you could call it.
All right. Well, Evan on Twitter asks, the traveling you guys did alone in the series seemed very expansive, at least from, you know, the trailer that a lot of people have seen. And aside from UFOs, I mean, the main topic of the series, did a certain area really speak to you guys or surprise you personally?
Well, we've talked about the Betty and Barney Hill location in the White Mountains for sure. But I think my absolute favorite, the spot I think about almost daily still and really want to go back to, is Sedona. Just watching the sunset in Sedona and the weather and just the experience of being that West Coast trip with Shannon, Jason, and Brandon was really special. And that one little stop was sort of, that was really important.
Yeah, I agree. Having the boys in my backyard and being able to show them everything around here. But also, that was my first time to Sedona. So yeah, I would agree. I would say that hike out, we're trying to find the vortexes, and you know, you'll have to see if we found them, and maybe we're talking from one right now. But yeah, sitting up on top of the rocks, and there was a whole bunch of people up there for that very reason. You know, there was people trying to park and there was no parking, and they're trying to scramble up these damn rocks to watch the sunset. And boy, it was worth it. Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
That's awesome. See, even, you know, again, aside from UFOs, like, what you take away from just this journey alone, I'm sure, gives you a deeper respect for how diverse the U.S. really is.
It's massive. Like, the trip, that's what I said, it's weird because I actually went to more places on the Trail of Bigfoot, but this felt expansive is a great word for it. It felt really, really, really just gigantic. When you really, I mean, there's things that we shot that did not make it into the series, like Shannon at Cape Canaveral. Like, we were at Cape Canaveral and it's not in the series. And, you know, it felt enormous in scope, and to close out it in Los Angeles, like one of the most populated cities on earth, and, you know, but still have that butted up against places like the Chestnut Ridge and the White Mountains is really astonishing.
You get this piece, this cross section of America that we don't see often. And I think it actually brings us more together, these things, than tears us apart, you know, and that's hard in the world today. So I got to thank you guys both for that before we continue here. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest part of On the Trail of, like, so far, if you really go through all three of the On the Trail of Champ, Bigfoot, and UFOs. It's the sense of place is probably the biggest special effect in the entire thing.
Yeah, it becomes its own character for sure. Pete on Facebook asks Shannon, is chasing the paranormal and hosting a podcast your full-time occupation? Or is this sort of like a side thing when you're not working? He finds it amazing that, you know, a person could actually like make a living doing these sorts of things. So, and he says how freaking cool that is. So, yeah, what do you got for that one, if you're willing to share?
It would be amazing, I would say. I don't know quite what that's like yet, but... you know, for all of you guys out there, Ryan Sprague and I actually share a birthday, August 8th. Yep. And that is not the only thing that we share, though. We share a way to make money besides our podcasting and book endeavors. I'm newly into that, of course, but we both are bartenders. So that is what I do for the bulk of my moolah.
Yeah, yeah. Got to pay them bills, guys. We, you know, that's as right. much as we'd like to be full-time researchers, this is often a side thing for us, a passion. You know, yeah. We clearly don't do it for the money. So that's the reality of all of this. Yeah,
There is certainly a misnomer out there that just because you have a podcast and maybe even a book or two out there that you're making a ton of money. But get into it and let's see how you guys do.
Yeah, you're often in the red. Let's be completely honest.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Sean on Facebook asks, after working on the series, do either of you have a deeper belief in the UFO phenomenon? Like, did it change your beliefs at all?
That's a good question. It's funny because I've been asked, like, if I feel like coming out of this that I know more or less, and I think I feel like I know less about UFOs.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of where I am. Like, I know that I'm much more fascinated in the actual phenomenon now than I was. Like before, I think there were little things that drew me to it. And obviously, like, I love the encounter stories and stuff like that. And like I said, the Cold War era. But I think I'm much more fascinated by the phenomenon as a whole now than I was before. So that's a big part of it for me.
Yeah, I think the more you know, the less you know. I've brought that up on several episodes, you know. But then we start to ask new questions. I think that's definitely mm-hmm. exciting. Shannon, how do you feel? Have your beliefs in UFOs or the topic in general changed at all?
I mean, I think the belief word is maybe a little bit strong. And you know, mm-hmm. no offense to Sean or anything. It's not a slightly misplaced word, but I would say yes, just because of the fact that, and it's not so much the UFO phenomenon itself. It's a belief. It's a knowing that there is something going on and it is certainly affecting people. And I say, yes, it has changed me in a way and have a deeper knowing that something's going on because I've never had a chance to sit down and talk to so many people back to back, face to face.
Yeah, absolutely. I know. And when you start to bring it together like that, it just becomes a lot more stronger. The case to be said for UFOs becomes stronger the more people you talk to.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of that, what are your – Bruce wants to know from Facebook, what are your personal thoughts on disclosure? And do you think we'll ever have it in our lifetime, and in what form might it take? What do you guys think about that, Seth?
No. I think we will – we'll probably hear something about UFOs being, you know, like, I mean, I think we've already had like the admittance that UFOs are real from mm-hmm. the government, mm-hmm. but no, I don't think we're going to get some sort of like, yes, aliens are here and they've been visiting Earth for X amount of, I don't see that happening.
Totally agree.
Yeah,
that would be my answer exactly.
I couldn't agree more with you guys. I think, again, it comes down to each person, one by one, having these experiences. I think mm-hmm. that's disclosure for them alone. And yeah, I mean, since that New York Times article came out, a lot of people consider that disclosure. You know, the government said UFOs exist. Now it's the question of what are they? What do they want? Who's in control of them? So, yeah, I would have to agree with you guys on that. Well, let's see. Ami on Facebook asks, Would you guys, could you name a current paranormal or Fortiana researcher's body of work that you're a fan of and why? And on the opposite side, if there's a researcher or body of work that you think too many people give credit or praise to.
Oh, damn. He really wants us to answer that second one, huh?
He wants to stir up the pot.
He wants to, oh man.
Depends on how negative you guys want to go with this. Yeah. Who do you look up to?
We can be negative, but you know.
Does it have to be ufology or is it kind of anything?
No, I think, you know, in terms of Fortiana, I guess we were talking about anything. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to go with a bunch of names that everyone's going to be like, oh, he's so boring. But Lauren Coleman, you know, go read old Lauren Coleman stuff. It's super cool. Like his 1970s work is really cool. And Jerome Clark is cool. Jerome and Lauren actually did a book together that's pretty rad. I think it's called The Unidentified in the reprint, but that wasn't the original title. And now I can't remember what the original title was. But Ivan Sanderson, I really like reading his old stuff. John Keel is pretty cool. I have issues with John's Mothman work right now that is only getting more and more present in my mind as the days go by, but I still really like John's work and the way he wrote. He was a good writer. And let me think. I'm trying to think of someone more recent that I've been getting into, but I feel like I plow through so many books just trying to get research done that if I don't really get to really appreciate that kind of stuff. So I don't know, man. Oh, Tobias Whalen's Lake Michigan Mothman book's really cool.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a reason I want to work with Tobias, and that book's part of it. Oh, and then the Pine Barrens Institute guy. Now I totally blanked on his name, but he did the book about historical monsters that I'm also failing to remember the name of the book. I'm going to find this. Let Shannon talk.
I'm not helping at all. I'm trying, Pine Barrens. I can see the logo and everything.
Yeah, same.
Shannon, well, you go and I'll get it in my head or I'll get it on Google.
Yeah. Now Siri can come into play. He already mentioned two names that I had written down, Coleman and Keel. I mean, John Keel is a go-to for most of us. And, you know, when you're talking to Fortiana, Bigfoot, I love Will Jevning. If you're talking about, if you get into Dogman stuff, you got, Linda Godfrey. I mean, there is a lot of people out there doing a lot of fantastic work.
Adam Benedict.
There it
Monsters
is.
Boom.
Yep.
Thank you, Google. Sorry, no, I mean, I'm so much on the plane of where Seth is. I'm kind of going, my wheels are turning. I've talked to a billion people and I can't remember six names to give you guys, but those are some of the heavy hitters out there, I think, that are doing fantastic work. They've been doing it for a very long time. They're very passionate about it, but of course the second we hang up we're gonna go, why didn't I mention so and so? But David, we can mention half the people that we talked to on the trail of UFOs, because a lot of these people are much like us in that they study a lot of different subject matter. So, Micah Hanks, I mean, these are people that they do the podcast, they do the books, they go to the conferences, they do all of these things.
Yeah. Well, what I think is interesting too is a lot of Shannon, the ITF crowd, they always wondered when you, me, and Sam would meet, and on the trail of UFOs is what finally made it happen.
That was awesome. Incredible. It would have been great, of course, to have it all at the same time, but it was on two separate coasts. You were not in LA still at that time. So, but hey, we met. That was all that mattered. And I think I was like, this is going to implode the internet finally when I post pictures with the boys, because that was a long time coming. So we have to thank Seth for that. He's the one that made that happen, And of course, me trying to pressure you guys, you're gonna do this, you're gonna get on camera, I don't care what you say.
No, it was a long time coming, and of course it would be UFOs that brought us together, so I couldn't be happier about that. But let's see here. Here's our last listener question. Philip on Facebook asks, if you two could ask one question of a government insider with alleged access to high level details on the UFO subject, what would it be?
What was the Kexburg craft?
Yeah, that's a good one, man.
I'm going to keep my comments to myself.
Oh, okay. On the Kexpert case?
Seth already knows because of my brain. He's been around me long enough. He's like, shut up, Shannon.
It looks like something, but...
I'm just going to... immature.
I don't want to know.
No.
you know. Because you've talked to me enough as well. No, mine would be hands down, have we ever recovered or do we have now the classic gray aliens? I want to, like, do we have the bodies? Do we have we ever had one alive? Have we ever recovered anything like that? Classic gray.
That's a good question. I like it. Let's see. I guess going back to chapter 8 of the series, Longer Way to Go. Yes, a lot of big questions in this series. So do you feel you met the goals you sort of set out to do with the project? Or what do you kind of hope the audience will take away from On the Trail of UFOs? Seth, I guess we'll start with you.
Yeah, that's cool. Because it's funny, the behind the scenes, what Shannon and I talked about a lot, and it's in the second trailer, but it's not in the series, is like this idea that people used to look to the skies with a sense of wonder and curiosity, and that's kind of gone. And it's mentioned a couple times throughout the series, but it's not really driven home as much as I would have liked it to have been. And that's because the mission statement of the series changed. That was originally the mission statement of the series, is like, you know, people don't look to the skies and, you know, then that kind of stuff. And then it became more about like, people don't put the focus on people. And so that became the mission statement. So maybe for season two, we'll do the other thing. But I think, what was the wording of the specific question you asked me before I start rambling? Because I want to make sure I actually answer it. How did you word that again?
Yeah. What do you hope the audience will take away from the entire project?
Yeah. So, I think it really is just the fact that the subject itself is worthy of looking into, regardless of how skeptical or whatever you are, that the subject itself is looking into, devoid of the celebrities and some of the programming you might already have hardwired into you because of movies, you know, of this being a terrifying subject to look into, and it's all scary movie stuff and that kind of thing. Like there is something very, very innocent, not innocent. That's the totally wrong word. Not innocent, but there is something awe inspiring about the idea that there are things flying around our skies that we don't know what they are in a world where we have the technology we do. You know, and it's kind of the same way that I feel about like something like Bigfoot. You can look into this stuff and come at it from your own place, like your own perspective, and don't feel like you have to be hardwired by what television and books and all that kind of stuff tells you. Just come into it and figure things out for yourself. And it's a subject worth looking into and spending time on. And if nothing else, you'll meet some really cool people. You'll also meet a ton of crazies and a lot of people that will, there's going to be times where you feel very demoralized being involved in this.
Yeah.
But it is worth looking into and spending time on, and bring your own perspective to it. And if nothing else, it's like Greg Bishop kept talking about, and put the focus on the people. Like, you know, like my goal became to put the focus on everyone, like not just the experiencers and the witnesses, but that's probably the most important part of it. But also like people like Ryan, like why is Ryan into this? Why has Ryan spent so much time on it? Why, you know,
he's
like what drives
Ryan himself that question today?
Yeah, like but those things get overlooked a lot. You know,
yeah,
like we're
right.
Someone like Ron Regier has been in this for like 50 years, same as Stan Gordon, like 50 years of his life. Longer, you know, maybe longer for Stan, like invested in looking to the skies. And what drives someone to do that, and what kind of impact will that have? You know, I asked you, Ryan, like when you die, when is this going to have been worth your time? You know, like essentially that was what I asked you.
Yeah.
And like there are some philosophical questions that get brought up in that last episode. I think I forget about that. But yeah, that's the biggest thing. It's just, man, there's a ton to this subject beyond what you're going to find on on TV, and I'm not running down television either. I'm saying the crowd that comes into this is, and the younger people that are going to come into this are going to come into it because of whatever's on television or whatever's online that they're checking out. Like, that's what's going to drive them to the subject. But look beyond that. Like, there's a lot more.
Absolutely. Yeah, Shan, do you have anything to add to that?
I have nothing to add. Nothing. I mean, Seth said it beautifully. No, I did. And I think it just ties back into something I'll parrot from earlier, is that just being able to sit with so many different kinds of people with varying beliefs in the subject and different, they've got a different mindset as far as the tactics they go about either trying to, you know, contact it or, you know, from an experiencer standpoint, maybe trying to figure out just what in the hell happened to them, really. And again, the perception comes into that, not to just rehash what I said. But yeah, I think just being able to sit down with so many different kinds of people is something that, I mean, it's going to stay with me forever. And I think that it definitely got me way more into the subject of UFOs than I was before.
Yay, we got another one. I love it.
Hooked me in. Oh, crap.
Oh, wow. Guys, this has been amazing. Before we go, can you maybe tell us a little about what projects you got coming next? Seth, what can we expect from Small Town Monsters moving forward? And yeah, give us everything that's coming next, man.
Yeah, we added a whole new production for this year.
that was quite a surprise.
You didn't have enough to do.
Kind of surprising to us, honestly. It's so On the Trail of UFOs is coming out March 20th, Amazon, Vimeo On Demand, coming to DVD and Blu-ray. We are, oh heck, who cares? We're negotiating to get like a wide release for this thing. I don't know how those negotiations are going to go. I'm not crazy about distributors. I remain to not be crazy about distributors. So, but we are negotiating with a distributor that would get this out to a much larger audience. So hopefully that goes well and we can do that. And if that's the case, it'll be sort of everywhere. But regardless, after On the Trail of UFOs, we are beginning production for On the Trail of the Lake Michigan Mothman. This will start shooting on March 26th in Chicago. So I will be in Chicago with again, like On the Trail of just constantly has a shifting cast of crew, and this one won't have Shannon, unfortunately. It's going to be a new well, our leads in this one are Tobias and Emily Whalen, and so we'll be sort of investigating the Mothman Lake Michigan stuff with them. This will be shot by, this is what I'm most excited about, is so I've been trying to work with Andrew Peterson for like 4 years. Andrew used to do a website. I can't remember. I think it was like Weird Midwest or something like that.
Oh yeah, yep, but I remember that.
But he's a amazing cinematographer, and him and I have been talking for years about working together. We couldn't get it together. This is going to be the project where he's finally going to be a DP for something that I'm directing. So this is going to be really cool. It's going to be shot by him. It's going to have a very investigative detective vibe. I mostly just sent him a bunch of photos from the movie Brick with Joseph Gordon-Levitt to tell him what I'm envisioning.
Nice.
For this. So this is going to be a special On the Trail of Two, because it's not episodic. It's going to be basically what we're calling it is like a special episode of a TV show. So you know how like TV shows like TGIF, we all know Family Matters and all that. They would do the special episodes and they'd be like an hour long or whatever. That's what this is going to be. It's going to be a special episode of On the Trail of. It's going to be extended and it's going to be about one topic. So that'll be out hopefully in June. Late June is what we're trying to do with that. It's going to be a quick turnaround. We are in production for The Mothman Legacy. And at the end of the year, we'll be putting out The Mark of the Bellwitch. We are also filming On the Trail of Bigfoot Season 2 over the course of this year. The big trip coming up for that one is going to be British Columbia, which I'll be doing in August for On the Trail of Bigfoot Season 2. And we are also hoping On the Trail of UFOs Season 1 does really well so we can launch Season 2. So if you're interested in seeing On the Trail of UFOs do more, please watch and support on the Trail of UFO season one.
Absolutely.
I think that's it. I think, we have a book coming out called Making Monsters that will be out for Kickstarter backers. There may be a few copies available in our web store, but not many.
That's awesome, man. Shan, how about you? What do you got coming up?
Well, I've got the second book, Beyond the Fray Paramalgamation, which will be coming out hopefully in the next few weeks. We're going to look for an early release on that. And, of course, Beyond the Fray Bigfoot is out. And I'm still doing the podcast. It comes out every Thursday, 7 p.m. PST, IntoTheFrayRadio.com. And, of course, any and all podcatchers, YouTube, iHeart, Radio, Spotify, the usual offenders for catching a podcast.
Right. And then I also saw you put out a call for UFO stories. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely. And, you know, not to steal any thunder from your show, of course, Ryan, because that seems like a little bit of a butting of heads there. But yeah, I am looking for, of course, some that are willing to come on the show and some that maybe are not. They don't ever want to come on a podcast in their whole life. Maybe they just want to write it out to me or have a private conversation, and then I translate that into the written word. So yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. I always say it, the more UFO stories out there, the more we can normalize the topic and get more people interested and involved. Yeah. and show people this is a topic worth pursuing, which I think is the epitome of what On the Trail of UFOs has done for me personally and for a lot more people out there, I hope. So, yes, I got to thank both of you guys for coming on today. This has been absolutely amazing, not just talking to you, but being a part of this. I was so honored to just give my thoughts and opinions on all the research I've done throughout the years to an audience who will hopefully take something away from that. And yeah, I can't wait to see the series in its entirety, and I know my audience will too. So thank you to the both of you for coming on Somewhere in the Skies.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Ryan.
Somewhere in the Skies is produced by Third Kind Productions in association with the Entertainment One Podcast Network. To learn more, visit entertainmentonepodcast.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.